It's in Bereshit, Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12. chapter 12, from Pasuk Yud, which is 10. We're going to be taking up that story tonight, but for next week, prepare also a very similar story. This is the story of Abraham going to Egypt and his encounter with the Pharaoh. That's what I'm doing today. But in general, for next week, bear this in mind. Prepare also the story. A very similar situation occurs in the next Seder in Vayera. That's in next week's Seder. This is to be studied in conjunction with the story in Bereshit. That's in chapter 20, where Avram, say a very similar adventure, where Avram finds himself in a strange land, and he fears that the people there would take his wife and would kill him. So how he responds in both situations. On the surface, they seem to be rather similar. But if you study it carefully, you'll notice some important differences. Now tonight I'm just going to take up the story of Abraham in Egypt and his encounter with Pharaoh, which is a simpler story. And we'll raise the pertinent questions and we'll try and answer them. And I'll point out some of the differences as they are relevant tonight, but you have a whole week to look over the story for next week and try and anticipate the issues. Now tonight we're doing chapter 12, I said. Let's go through the story, and as we do so, just see if you can come up with the question. What seems strange? Remember, the best question is the most obvious question. So whatever bothers you, whatever is troublesome to you, that's the methodology. The way to really get into the deeper ideas of the Chumash is through the method of questioning properly, to isolate the problem. All right, now, by way of introduction, this parasha of Lech Lecha begins with God appearing to Abraham, and he was at that time in Ur Kasdim, the land of his birthplace, but I can't go through the entire history now. That's a different subject. He was raised among people who were idolaters, worshipped the idols, was steeped in idolatry, and through his own reasoning, he discovered the true concept of God, the God of nature, what created the world, and he began teaching people that all their ideas were false, that their entire concept of religion was a false one, and that everything that they were doing was of no purpose and was actually corrupting and destroying them. As a result of this, he got into trouble with the authorities, and as the Rambam points out, God saved him through miraculous means, and then God told him to leave that land. And this is the beginning of his journey, because he was at that point designated to become the leader of a great movement, the father of the Jewish nation. Now what's the idea of the Jewish nation, why there is a Jewish nation, and why Abraham is the father of that nation, and what the purpose of all these journeys are, we're not going to take up tonight. But of course, those are important issues, and if you make note of them, I'll take them up at a different time. Any time you take up one area in Chumash, it's going to bring many other issues into question. I mean, you have to touch upon many other things. I can't take them all up at the same time. Anyway, suffice to say that Abraham responded to God's command, and he left his native land. So after Avram follows God's command and he uproots himself, and together with his nephew Lot and their wives and all of their possessions, they leave the land and they go to settle in the land of Canaan. And God appears to him in the land of Canaan and tells him that he's going to be the leader of a great... He's going to be a very important historical figure. He's going to play a very important role in history, and nations will be blessed through him, and that this eventually will be the land of his descendants. Then it says, quite suddenly, by Hirov Ba'aretz, that's where we took up the story from. There was a famine in the land, and Avram went down to Mitzrayim to dwell there. Now the term lo gershom, to dwell, that means with the intention of it being temporary. He did not go against God's command, because God wanted him to be in the land of Canaan. He had to leave due to the famine, but his intention was to go there temporarily and then to return. As it says, kichaved harav ba'aretz, because the famine was very strong, was very powerful in the land. Now, why does the pasuk have to emphasize that? Wouldn't it be enough to simply say that there was a famine in the land and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there? Why must it then repeat, for the famine was very powerful in the land? Interesting technique in Chumash. The Torah doesn't repeat anything. The Torah doesn't mention anything unnecessarily. So there's little giveaways. If you notice them, you can develop a feel for it after a while. You develop a feeling for what superfluous. The Torah does not engage in superfluity or whatever. I agree. It's telling us about the character of Abraham that the ordinary person, there's a difference between Abraham and the ordinary person. Now, what does it show you precisely about Abraham? It shows you where his primary concern lies. Now, the average person, even if they're interested in the important things in life, at the same time, they want to study Torah, they want to improve themselves in knowledge, and so forth. But what's their primary thrust? What's their primary motivation? And the most primary thing that people are concerned with is necessity, or parnasa, security. Security is like the overwhelming thing. And that's why people get upset if things occur to them, their health or their possessions, whatever, is a different reaction. If a person has a religious problem or a religious question, or he notices that he's involved in things he shouldn't be doing, it's not such a crisis for him as if there's a leak in the pipes, or something is wrong with his car, or you got a flat tire, and there's a serious problem, and it may cost a few $100. So there's a totally sense of different attitude in people. Even people that are very serious about the important things in life. So, the average person, that comes first. If there's a problem at work, or a job, or the economy, all these things drive them. So the average person, if there was bad conditions, if there was a famine, wouldn't wait till the last minute. Because that comes first. So you anticipate. Well, you anticipate. And situations look bad, so you move on. Now, that's not a bad idea. One should be rational in these areas. But this was Avram staying in Canaan was not just a practical thing. He was there for a purpose, and it was dictated by God. So therefore, you shouldn't think that his leaving was because, all right, so things got bad, there was a famine, but he did so. He could have stayed longer, he could have waited it out, but he did it because of prudence. It's smart to anticipate and to leave before the situation gets that desperate. Now, this, in ordinary cases, that's the way it would be, but not in this situation. In this situation, he was driven by desperation, that there was no other alternative. That's why he had to touch Chavit HaRavar. Whereas in any other situation, it wouldn't be necessary to do that. If Abraham being there was not because of the command of God, then he would have left at the first signs of difficulty, which is a smart thing to do. You anticipate. In general, one should anticipate. But in this situation where his spiritual life was at stake, there, that comes first. And that's the way it should be when your spiritual life is at stake. And then in any other area, in other words, let's assume moving. Let's try and apply it to our own lives. Like a lot of people may have a tough time, let's say living in New York. Let's say that's the best situation for Jewish life. Let's assume that's the case. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But there's ground. I mean, it's a Jewish community, and there's plenty of shuls, and Jewish atmosphere, and there's yeshivas, and all of that. So it's very conducive to a person's life. But he's not doing too well economically. Economically, he could do much better somewhere else. He could improve his economic situation somewhere else. Life would be easier. But at the same time, he'd be sacrificing in terms of his involvement in Torah. So what should he do? Well, that would be the test which would show the level that he's on. What is his primary motivation? A person's primary motivation in life is the struggle for security and comfort and to better himself materially, so that's going to come first. Of course, he wouldn't go to a place where there's no Torah. He can't do that. There's a shul there. There's a yeshiva. There's learning. It's not going to be as good as New York. But look, my whole lifestyle will improve. So lifestyle is what he's really driven by. However, for a person whose major preoccupation is his perfection, his involvement in Torah, and everything else he's used as a means for that, so then he's willing to take upon himself greater burdens and to work harder, because the benefit, that spirit, that qualitative benefit of being in the proper environment is worth more to him than everything else. That's the case of that's why it does the chaved hara of baris, that when it comes to your involvement in Torah, then everything else has to be secondary. And the only time you can leave is when it's completely impossible, and you have to stay there as long as you can, with the confidence that God will help you. If, however, it turns out that you can't, so then you have to go. You have to go, and that's the only reason why he would have left Eretz Yisrael. Okay, let's go further. And it was when he approached, when he came close to Egypt, and he said to his wife Sarai, this is before her name was changed to Sarah, behold, now I know that you are a beautiful woman. Alright, well, we know for a fact from the Torah itself and from the rabbis on the basis of the tradition that the imahos, the mothers, the matriarchs as they're known, were exceedingly beautiful women, physical beauty. And that seems to be something which is... Well, Leah was an exception. But some say that that's only by comparison to Rachel. Rachel was more beautiful. So whatever the case, so she's an exception. But the Torah ascribes importance to this. The fact, it puts an emphasis upon that, and really that's the question, because in general, we don't associate the greatness of the tzaddikim and tzidkaniyos, that is the righteous men and righteous women. Physical beauty is not something that really doesn't seem to be an important value in Judaism. It's not something that we really, I mean, according to the Torah, I'm not saying the Jewish people, but the Torah itself doesn't really place great emphasis that that's really something that's very important. And yet it does point out, Rashi points out in Chayisar, that it mentions that she was May 127, that she was as beautiful at 127 as she was at 100 and at 20 and so forth. And what? Yeah. What was it? Right. So there must be a reason for it. Why is the Torah put an emphasis upon this when it's not the thing that we're told to really pursue in life? But there's something very interesting over here. The Mefarshim point out that, it's very strange. The public itself is very strange, and it sort of begs for interpretation. Now, all of a sudden, he notices. What do you mean, he did not know that she was beautiful until now? They were married for a while, I would imagine. In fact, they were married even before he came to Canaan. Didn't he know that he was married to a beautiful woman? Right, that's true, but you happen to be correct, but the expression hine no yadaki is sort of like hine, behold now I know. It's like suddenly he's noticing her beauty, suddenly the beauty. Although you're right, quite literally it's not saying that he discovered it now. Rashi says, he quotes a medrash, a very interesting medrash, and those who have Rashi can follow it. Medrash Agada. Now this is a medrash. A medrash means that it's a lesson that the rabbis, an interpretation the rabbis gave to the pasuk, which is not the literal meaning of the pasuk. It's intended to teach the lesson. Medrash Agada. This is the Agadic interpretation. Ad achshav lo hikir ba. Until now, he did not recognize her beauty. Mitoch tnius shevishneim, because of the modesty that existed between them. The achshav hikir ba al yedei maisa, but now he recognized it through an incident, through some occurrence. So the medrash is telling us that that's the, now how do they know this? Because that's the implication of the words. It's like behold. Behold means a sudden discovery. It doesn't mean now. But like behold implies that he suddenly discovered something which he wasn't aware of before. Now that wouldn't be so bad. Alright, so it's telling us about this tremendous modesty that it's hard for us to understand that a couple should have such modesty that they don't know what they look like. But anyways, let's assume that that's true. But I think we have a problem. There's another interpretation. There's two midrashic interpretations. But what's the plain meaning of the verse? You always have to study the plain meaning of the verse. Now, the Rashi Kinyan Zavaracha, another interpretation. Minag ha'olam, it is the custom of the world, shal yidei torach ha'derech, that because of the weariness of the road, adam mizbazer, a person becomes disheveled, loses their good looks. In other words, when people are traveling, I'm sorry? Yeah, when you're on the road, it takes its toll and it shows itself in how you look, your appearance. A person looks disheveled, they lose their good looks. V'zos amda b'yofya, but this one remained in her beauty. So what is that telling us? And this always troubled me, just because I know when the rabbis tell us something like this, they're trying to convey a message. Now what are they trying to tell us? That she was such a super beauty that even on the road she was... Why do I have to know this? I mean, we're here to learn moral lessons, we're not here to learn about the beauty. This is like something you'd read in one of these magazines, you know, about some starlet who, in spite of everything, is still beautiful. Now what is it telling us about Sarah? But before I go into that, I think we have a very profound problem over here. If you take a look at the next part of Rashi, those who have Rashi, Upshuto shel mikra, but what is the plain meaning of the verse? And this is, people get confused between the plain meaning and the medrash. Pshuto shel mikra, the plain sense of the verse, which has to be true, is as follows. Exactly what, you said, I know your name? Davida? Nice to meet you. Upshuto shel mikra, the plain meaning of the pasuk is, Hine no higia hasha. It means that, behold, the time has come, sheyesh lidag al yafyach, that I have to worry about your beauty. Yadati zeh yomim rabim. I have known this for many days. Ki yafas mara'at, that you're a beautiful woman. V'achshav anubam beit anashim shchorim umuchorim. And now we're about to enter amongst people who are black and ugly. Acheim shel kushim, the brothers of the Kushites. Below her glue, Ishiyafa, and they're not accustomed to a beautiful woman. Now, what is the problem of this? So, what's the plain? The plain meaning is not that he didn't know that he was married. He knew it all along. But he's saying now, until now, didn't pose any problem. Now it's something that we have to take into consideration because we're coming amongst the people that are not accustomed to this, and who knows, it's going to be dangerous for us. Now, there's a problem, though. I think that there is if you read the entire Rashi over here, is a serious problem. What's the problem? Can anybody detect it? Okay. In other words, a medrash, an interpretation, can go beyond the plain meaning and add something deeper. There's a deeper level. There's a simple level, and there's a deeper level, but they don't contradict each other. They should be in line. But here we have a situation where the medrash, the interpretation, contradicts the plain meaning. Now, what am I to believe? What's the reality? The medrash says that he did not know that she was beautiful because of their extreme modesty. The plain meaning of the pasuk, which has to be true, if you accept the Torah as true, is telling us that he did know, but rather there was nothing to worry about. There was no problem. So how can the medrash, how can we resolve this contradiction? They have to be harmonious. The rabbis cannot teach us anything that goes against the plain meaning of the Torah. The plain meaning of the Torah is true. Okay? Rashi has two midrashim. And one, and the plain meaning. That's another medrash. Oh, well, because Rashi is bothered by the fact, what is his emphasis? Behold, it's like he's saying something in surprise. Like, he's amazed, you're so beautiful. And the question is, what do you mean, didn't you know? So the first answer says, no, until now he didn't know. That's why he's surprised. The second answer is saying, he's surprised because it's not the custom for people to look so beautiful when they're traveling. They lose their look, they lose their beauty, but she didn't. Then he says, well, 1 second. That's just interpretation. We're reading into it. What's the plain meaning? The plain meaning is that I've known all along, but now it's a problem, because we're about to enter a land of wild animals. I would say like this, that both are true. If you ask, a person can know something. In other words, in the sense that he has that information. That information is within his mind. But, in other words, if you ask, did Avram know factually, did he have that information that she was a beautiful woman? The answer is yes. And the Medrash accepts that. What the Medrash is saying is that the fact of her beauty had absolutely no psychological significance in the nature of the relationship. The relationship was based upon their appreciation of their virtue, so that the fact of a physical beauty was something they didn't even think about. It had no significance then. That was not part of, that's the theist. That was not the basis. That's what the Medrash is teaching us. So in other words, he knows it as a fact, but this fact is of absolutely no significance in whatsoever. In other words, if, for example, if a person, that's the theist. Yeah, he recognized, no, he was realistic. He wasn't naive. He wasn't naive. The tzaddik is not naive. The tzaddik is very much aware of what's going on in the world. So to him, well, that can be dangerous, though. Most people function, their understanding of other people is based upon their own psyche. So what's not important to them, they assume is not important for others. But Avram was a great man of understanding of human nature. But I just... It is true. Yitzhak was different. Well, when we get to Yitzhak, it is true. Yitzhak was a bit naive when it came to understanding human nature. As you see, he was wrong about Esau. And Rivka was more intuitive. Now, I have a whole theory about that. I'm not going to be labeled sexist, so I really don't care. I have a whole theory about the difference between male intellectual functioning and female intellectual functioning when we take up that story. But I'm not going to disclose it right now. Yeah, so that answers the question. There's no contradiction then. I think in many cases, for example, let's say a person has a house or a car, whatever it is, and he's only interested in how it functions. He built it purely for functionality, and the aesthetic has absolutely no significance to him. Now, he knows that it's regarded as aesthetically beautiful, but he just, it's not on his mind. Then somebody comes along and says, wow, what a beautiful, it's so beautiful, isn't that? So, like, to him, like, he knows that it's there, but this is of no, that's not the important thing. It's the functionality. Whereas to another, that's the way it was with Avram. He knew that she was beautiful, but it had no psychological significance. It didn't form any component in his attachment, in the attachment. That's the thing. As far as the other pshat, what it's telling us about, I have a hunch, I'll try it. In other words, why is the pasuk, why, according to the other matters, why is it pointing out that she was unique, that most people lose their look when they're very weary and on the journey, but she remained in her beauty? What is it trying to tell us? That she has a beauty secret? What's the thing? In other words, what I was thinking of is correct, that a large component in beauty is really the inner psychological state. When a person, to a large extent, when a person is not feeling right, they just don't look good. No matter how, so beauty is not just a purely physical phenomenon. It's not just form. Right? A lot has to do with a certain brightness that a person has. Certain people look better. They look better because of that inner contentment. The inner contentment, the inner state has a lot to do with it. Now, the reason why people look bad in a journey, it's not because physically it's so, has such an effect, but because they can't tolerate it. It goes against their own narcissism. They like sort of withdraw into themselves. They withdraw into themselves. They feel the bush of it. Yeah. I mean, that's right. A person feels deprived. A person feels deprived when he doesn't have his comfort. He's away from his comfort, right? And when he's but people get upset. They get very upset, and they become a little bit childish, and they sort of withdraw into themselves. And when they have that withdrawn look, withdrawn into themselves, like they don't want to look at the world. So that takes away from their beauty. So it's not just a physical thing. All right, let's proceed now. Now we get to the essence of what this is all about. So he says like this: "V'hoyu ki yiro sechamitzra," and it'll be when the Egyptians see you, the Amru, and they will say, Ishtozos, that's his wife. Vahargu osi, the osachichayu. So they'll kill me, and you, they'll keep alive. So he's got a problem. The problem is that they're going to want her, they're going to be attracted to her, and what they'll do is they'll kill him, and they'll take her. So what's his plan? Imri no achosiyad, please say that you're my sister. In order that they will be good to me because of you, and they'll save my life for your sake. All right. Now, what is difficult over here? Let's pause for a second. I think the problems there are pretty obvious, but Renee, people are troubled by this. That was it right for him to do this? To be purely concerned for his own survival and not concerned about the fact that she would be violated. What that's a terrible thing. According to Judaism, for Aisha Tish, I mean, any woman could be violated, but certainly a married woman. To let her be subjected to the experience of adultery here, being taken by a stranger. That's one problem. Well, one thing, this is talking about before Matan Torah. So, and that, well, I don't know if that's meant to be taken literally. I don't know that that's taken literally. I thought to say that when they kept Tariag, it means literally, because there's so many mitzvahs that are dependent upon the Yetzias Mitzrayim and so forth. But let's take a look at this. There's something strange again. I want to take a look at the pasuk. Yeah, please. Imrina, please. Thank you. But first of all, you should learn from all this, because people have a misconception. People have a misconception of the role of women and the nature of the relationship in the Torah. You see the way he spoke to her. Even when his life was in danger, still he spoke to her with respect, and it's something that she had to be willing to do. He didn't force her around. Nevertheless, he's showing respect for her. He's presenting the plan, and he wants to hear her opinion. She's a very intelligent woman. She had prophecy. She was on a very high level, and they're basically like equals. They're functioning as equals. So he's presenting, and they didn't always agree. As a matter of fact, they disagreed with the case of Hagar. They disagreed on the case of Yishmael. She wanted to send him away because she thought he was a bit. Avram disagreed, and then God said, "Whatever Sarah says, listen to her. That's going to be part of my shiur on the difference in the way." You see, women function intellectually and men function. But what about your gimel? Just take a look at the pasuk. I'm trying to teach you methodology. Again, look at the pasuk very carefully. There's something in that pasuk that always bothered me very much. Ah. See, one thing I can understand. In other words, let's put it this way. The request that she say that she is a sister in order that he should be kept alive, that I can understand. Because we have to assume that they had no choice. There was no other place that they could go. This is the only place where they could go. Now, in this situation, he's afraid that they're going to be attracted by her beauty and they're going to take her. Now, that does nothing you can do at this stage. You can't stop that in any way. So either he can tell the truth that that's his wife, and they'll just kill him and take her anyway. So what has he gained? He hasn't gained anything. Or else, he can say that she's his sister, that he's the brother, in which case they may take her. In other words, he's not, by making up this story, he's not making the situation worse. He's not contributing anything to their taking her. They're going to take her anyway. So he's of no use to her if he's dead. At least if he's alive, first of all, he's alive. He saved his life. And then if God intervenes and helps them, he'll still be alive. So a person has to do everything possible to make the best out of the situation. And then hope for a miracle. But meanwhile, he took measures at least to preserve his own life. So that part I understand. But then he also mentions, "L'man yitav li bavurech," in order that they will be good to me. What is he referring to? That they'll benefit him, that he'll become wealthy. As we see later on, they gave him tremendous gifts. He became very wealthy as a result of this. Now that's very strange. Because it would seem from this that part of his motivation in asking her to go through with this was not just to save his life, but to become wealthy. Now that sounds horrible. You mean he would want to pose as a brother and let her be taken for adultery to save his life? Yes. But for wealth, Abraham? That's a very, very powerful question that always bothered me. And if you're going to say that's not what motivated him, right? But he's just saying that, he's just describing what's going to happen. But why does the Torah have to make a point of this? Did he say this because that would make Sarah more prone to doing it? That would motivate Sarah? I mean, if Sarah's going to do it, she's going to do it because she wants to save his life. She's not going to be motivated by the fact that they're going to get wealthy. So therefore, why mention the factor of getting wealthy? What does that have to do with it? Certainly, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the main consideration is we'll stay alive. The fact that we'll get some money, I mean, is of no consequence. Why bring it up at this point? Yeah? Now let's see what happens. Then it was, now 14, and it was when Avram came to Egypt, And the Mitzrayim saw the woman, ki yofi himo, that she was beautiful. Vayir osa sari paro, and the ministers of paro saw her, vayahalu osa el paro, and they extolled her, they praised her to paro. Vatuka ka'isha based paro, and the woman was taken to the house of paro. And lo and behold, it worked out just like you predicted. Uli Avram hated Bavura, and they were very good to Avraham because of her. Vahilo son of Bakar, and they gave him sheep and cows, Vachamorim and donkeys, Vavadim and servants, Ushvachos, female servants, Vasonos, Ugmalam, camels and donkeys. Which we already Chamorim is what's a Chamorim? A male and a female. Alright, so the point of Tet Zion is that they gave him an exceedingly large sum of money. Okay, so that part of it came true. Then what happens next? And God smote Pharaoh, mighty, powerful plagues, and his household, because of Sarai, the wife of Avram. And Pharaoh called to Avram and said, "What is this that you did to me? Why didn't you tell me that she's your wife? Why did you say that she is my sister, and I took her to me as a wife? And now, here is your wife, take her and go." And Paro commanded men, in other words, to escort him, an escort, to see what they escorted him out of the land. And they sent him and his wife and all that was his, meaning he managed to keep all of them. So not only was he saved, and not only was she saved, but he walked away with a tremendous amount of wealth. So there's a few more questions over here that we have to raise. Anybody? It would seem that he had a lot of... Well, he had to go. He had to go. We don't know about the founding of it, but he had no choice on that one. All right. Now, are there any other questions that we've missed? Now, I would say... Was he letting him? Okay. Okay. I would say there are three main questions over here. No, I did not. Now, I would say that the main questions are, first of all, how did Pharaoh know? It doesn't say anywhere that anybody told him. How did Pharaoh know that she was that this was really his wife? And that, of course, it just says that Pharaoh was smitten with plagues. And then he calls Abraham and he gives him an argument. And he says, "Why didn't you tell me that she's your wife?" Well, how did he find that in the meantime? The pasuk doesn't mention anything that anybody told him. Suddenly he knows. Well, how did the plagues? The plagues didn't tell him anything. It's a plague. He figured it out? Also, two other questions. First of all, why didn't Avram answer him? He confronted Avram, and it seems he was angry, and it would seem from the general background of the story that his anger was justified. Because this question becomes even more powerful if you can contrast it with Avram's behavior in the Abimelech episode. Just briefly, if you turn to chapter 20. On chapter 20, verse 9, again, when Abimelech discovers the truth, he calls Abraham and he says to him, "What have you done to us, and what have I sinned to you, that you've brought upon me and my kingdom a great evil? Things that are not done, you have done with me." Referring to the fact that he said that she's his sister. And Abimelech said to Avram, "What did you see that you did this thing?" And then, from take a look at 11, 12, and 13, Avram answers him at great length. He has three different explanations, which I'm not going to go into right now. But Avram took the trouble and he went to great lengths to answer him and to try and explain to him why he did what he did. But over here, in this case, he doesn't say a word. Just takes everything and goes. Why didn't he answer Pharaoh? Why didn't he explain? And if the proper thing is not to explain, then why did he explain by Abimelech? Well, that's, of course, we're going to analyze, we're going to try and analyze the two different societies. And the third question is, where was the justice in the fact that Paro and his household, it wasn't just Paro, by the way, it says his entire household was smitten with plagues. Why were they deserving of punishment if on the surface they didn't commit any sin? Because they did not know the truth. In other words, his argument is that had I known, I wouldn't have done it. That's why he's angry at Avram. So where is God's justice in subjecting people to a punishment when, for all intents and purposes, they didn't know that they were sinning because they didn't know that he didn't tell that she is really his wife? Answer the main questions that we've raised. Now let's take this question that I asked before. When he says there on Pasuk Gimel, he says, please say that you are my sister in order that they'll be good to me because of you and they'll save my life for your sake. As we said before, it sounds strange that he would even mention the factor of wealth over here when the main concern was that he be kept alive. Now the Malbim gives an interpretation. I'm going to state his interpretation, which I happen to disagree with, but it's, you know, it's something to consider. He says like this. He says that Avram was concerned. He knew the nature of the Mitzrayim, that they were a... And by the way, this is an insight into Egypt, because this is a precursor of the Egypt that we're going to meet in Exodus, that the Jews were enslaved in the land of Egypt. But they were people that were basically on a low instinctual level, very primitive level. And he was afraid that they'd be attracted to Sarah. So what would it help if he would say that he was a brother? Because in those times, he says, it was the custom to give a great dowry, to give gifts to the guardian of the, whether it be the father, normally it would be the father. But when a man courted a woman and wanted to marry, so to ingratiate himself, he'd give great gifts, either to the father, and in this case, she presented herself as being a girl that didn't have a father, but this was her older brother who was a protector, so he would receive the gift. Now, one second. Now, he has a very interesting... The reason I'm mentioning it is because he has a very interesting idea. Now, by setting it up this way, he was in control of the situation. What he's saying is like this. So, any man that was attracted to her and would want to take her would have to come to him for the dowry. And he then would ask for an exceedingly large dowry, which they could not afford to give. And by doing that, he would be able to stave off any would-be suitor. And that's the way, that was his plan. But what happened, he never realized that it would go so far, that she was so attractive, that word was spread until he came to the king, who was loaded, he had everything, and he could... And according to the Malbim, it therefore did not work out as he had anticipated, and that's why God had to intervene to save him. But it's a very interesting, even ingenious kind of an explanation. Meaning, that would answer the question. That would answer the question of how would he subject her, even take a chance, by subjecting her to this situation. In other words, his plan was an ingenious and brilliant one, to set up a situation whereby he'd be in complete control, and when somebody came, he would set an exorbitant price, he'd be unreasonable, and they'd be discouraged, and until the famine. He felt all he needed was just to play for time. The whole idea was to play for time, because he's going to return to Canaan as soon as the famine passes. So after all the negotiating, up and back, as soon as he finds out, he can get out of there. Goodbye, and they're gone, and he saves it. It's a brilliant plan. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with the interpretation. And if you take a look at the Ramban, I don't buy it. And I'll tell you how I read the Pesukim. I would tell you this. If you take a look at the Pesukim, it's not by accident. It seems to be like a certain pattern over here. That first it says, look at the development. First the Egyptians saw the woman that she was beautiful. Then suddenly the ministers of Paro see her. Then they praise her to Paro. Then she's taken to the house of Paro. Now, according to Malbim, this just happened accidentally. According to him, that there was some negotiation going on, nobody could afford her, and I don't believe it. See, I believe that it was in the very nature of the situation. And let me explain. Ramban says this openly. And I think like this. Avram understood, he analyzed the nature of the society. What was the nature of the society, as some of you have said? Basically, they were steeped on the instinctual level. The level of the instinctual desires. However, that doesn't mean to say that that was the totality of their personality. There was another element in their personality. Because you see, there's an interesting ambivalence. For example, on the one hand, they're presented as being very primitive. They'll kill me. They wouldn't hesitate to kill me. On the other hand, they're going to give me great gifts. They're very, very nice. I mean, how do the two things go together? I mean, if they're a bunch of animals and they're ready to kill me, so then what are they going to give me? I mean, like, how does this work? But you have to understand it. It doesn't seem to make sense. On the one hand, they're a bunch of behemoths, and they'll just kill me in a second. On the other hand, they can be extremely nice. And let me ask you another question, which has been raised, okay, which has been raised by other commentaries. And the question is as follows. I don't know who raises this question. That if they didn't have any scruples about killing, because you see they're prepared to kill him, but he was afraid of him. So they didn't care about killing. So then why would they have any scruples about taking a married woman? Why would they care about adultery? You follow what I'm saying? In other words, why would they have to? Right? Why would they have to kill him? If he was only concerned about keeping himself alive, so then he could have told the truth that she's his wife, and they would have taken her anyways, because you see that they didn't care about killing the person. They'd violate the injunction against murder, so then by the same token, they would just leave him alone. Why'd they have to kill him? Why would they have to kill him? The only reason to kill him, they're going to kill him so they can, one second, they're going to kill him so they could have her. They can, one second, let me explain. They're going to kill him so that they can have her, because they don't want, as long as she's married, they can't have her. There's some, they have some kind of a problem with adultery. But murder doesn't bother them. We see, in other words, we can't have this woman because she's married. So we can't take her. So what do? We get rid of the husband. Oh, but murder is okay. I don't understand that. That's agreed. That, you see, I've understood their nature, that they're basically instinctual, but they also had a superego. They also had a conscience. They weren't entirely without a conscience. That's what you have to understand. And that under the right circumstances, they could be very nice, they could be very generous. It all depends upon how it, and you'll see that they had a conscience. I'll point out from the story that they were not lacking in conscience. They were not lacking in what we call superego, but they were instinctual. And in the right situation, for example, a perfect example of this would be the mafia. The mafia can be extremely harsh, but there's a certain code, there's a certain honor, and they can be extremely generous. In the right situation, for the right people, at the right time, when they celebrate and they make a wedding, they want to be generous. They want to be, in other words, they want to be known as nice guys as well. Except if you get in their way, they'll have no scruples, that's business. They violated the code, we have to get rid of you. But under different circumstances, they can be very helpful. In fact, John Gotti is very, very popular in his day. He does a lot of good things. People love him. And it's not just, of course he does it for practical reasons, but no, they do have this streak within them. They want people to like them. They want to be nice as well. It's no contradiction. As long as they get what they want. So therefore, it's exactly as you said. Because, David, as you mentioned, that there's a difference. It's easier to kill, because killing, you can always find an excuse, and you can cover the blood, as you see in the case of Cain, and that you can just blot out of your mind. It doesn't bother your conscience. It's easier to kill and blot it out of your mind. That's the case of Cain. And he covered, and that's why God cursed the earth, that covered the blood, because by covering and burying, he just wiped it out of his mind, and that's when God confronted him. He said, I don't know, am I my brother's keeper? Psychologically, he was able to simply repress it. It didn't bother him. An amazing case. This still boggles my mind, but you've heard about the case. The case that was on Most Wanted, John List. Now, that's an amazing phenomenon. One of the most amazing crimes I've ever read about. He was a deeply, so to speak, religious person. And for whatever crazy reason, he killed his mother and his wife and his three children. The most horrendous crimes that, you know, anybody can imagine. I just read a book about it. He went on to live a normal life until he was caught. For 18 years, And I was wondering, now, how could this person go through every day? It's got to haunt him. It's got to haunt him. He's got to be smitten. I mean, I can imagine a person be smitten with guilt. No. He just pushed it out of his mind. He went on, built a new life, did whatever he wanted to do out in Denver, a new identity. And he said, after they apprehended him, it's only by accident because of his television program, he would have been still free. And he said, he's not insane. He is not insane. Whatever the case, yeah, I know. There are other, believe me, there are other factors. There are a lot of financial. I know, but that's not so easy. People, I know, but anybody that has some conscience will have to question himself. And that, first of all, that wouldn't apply to his mother. It wouldn't apply to his mother. She was not the one who was sinning. And his children, it was the daughter and the wife. And there are a lot of financial issues over there, so it wasn't as simple if you read the book. A guy has to question himself. He's got to have some guilt after doing anything like that. No, he said in the early years, on the anniversary of the killings, being so guilty is fine to me. I'm Jewish. I can't contemplate living without guilt. I don't know how it's possible. Especially if where it's warranted. I mean. Anyways, but that happens to be the reality. It's much easier to get rid of somebody and cover it because you're only concerned with public opinion. But to actually take a man's wife to commit adultery, that's openly admitting that we have no morality over here. And that, no, they're a society. See, the mafia, too. They all have girlfriends and everything, but they make a clear-cut distinction. You don't bring it home. It's your wife, it's the wife, it's the girlfriend. So you can't, and if another thing, I use the mafia as a good illustration. If somebody fools around with somebody else's wife, that's a serious no-no. You don't do that, and you can get killed for doing a thing like that. So, the entire society basically was established on that foundation. And what happened was like this. It wasn't by accident. It wasn't by accident that she wound up in the house of Pharaoh. And this is, the Ramban says this openly, that it was a known thing that when a beautiful woman like this entered the kingdom, this was pointed out, you know, was pointed out to the higher up, to the ministers, and they praised her to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh had first choice. See, in that organization, it was an own thing. No Egyptian would dare take her for himself. Exactly. That's the way the society was established. I say, if you read the book, if it's not by accident, it seems to me that that's the way the society was geared. Everybody knew that if you found an exceedingly beautiful woman, that Pharaoh had first choice. And therefore, nobody would dare. That's why, you see, the ministers, why didn't one of the ministers take her himself? Couldn't do that. Had he done so, he would have gotten the job with Pharaoh. He had no right. He had first claim on any beautiful woman. And Avram realized that. And that's why his calculation was correct. That if they thought that he was the husband, then they couldn't take her without killing him. They'd have to kill him. Because to take her would be an open admission that we have no society. Adultery is permitted. No, that they can't. However, what would they do? Well, what about they can't admit that they're a bunch of murderers either. That can be done in a secret way. That we can always find, set him up, he had an accident. He can always have an accident, and we just go on from there and live happily ever after. But if he is the brother, then they're nice guys. They want to be nice guys. See, that's the other part of them. The other part of them is that they want to be known as nice guys. So that's the brother. They want it to be happy. It'll make you happy, make him happy. You see, they're generous. They're not stingy. So they gave him excessive gifts because that's fully in line with their desires. In other words, if you're operating, that's what he explained to her. He explained to her his plan. If you're operating in line with their desires, then they'll keep me alive and they'll benefit me as well. But that wasn't the motivation. I'm sorry, you had a question? What was the plan? Now, how did the Hashkacha work? At this point, God intervened. At this point, Avram has done everything that he could do, and Hashkacha meaning God's providence. God intervened. Now, what was the plan of God to save them? See, they were smitten with a great plague. Now, it doesn't tell you how Pharaoh suddenly knew that he was dealing with a married woman. Now, when he first took her, he didn't know that she was a married woman. Now, as the commentaries point out, that the plagues were of a sexual type of a illness that made having sex very painful. It afflicted them. It was all right. Now, what do you see from that? You see that they were. I mentioned that they were instinctual people, but they had super ego. They were extremely superstitious people. The Egypt. You follow? And this, they were very super. People are extremely superstitious, and they read into things. So it happened in such a way, as soon as she came into the palace, suddenly everybody was smitten with a sexual kind of an illness. It was done in a way which was clearly associated with that event. Now, if a person is purely scientific, so what? I mean, it's coincidence. Well, what does one thing have to do with the other? But God knew their nature. They were extremely superstitious, and they were very scared. They were petrified. They didn't follow the Torah. If they followed the Torah, well, of course. Excuse me. A person that lives his life that way, that when bad things happen to him, he begins to examine his motivation and tries to improve himself. That's a high-level person. This doesn't fit the character we're talking about. Do you think that's the way the mafioso live? But they're very suspicious kind of people. They have a rabbit's foot. They have pain. They have all these different things. And it's spooky. This is like a spooky kind of a thing. Now, the Ramban says that when it happened, it stopped him in his tracks. It stopped him in his tracks, and then he knew that it had to do with Torah somehow, and the Torah doesn't spell it out, but the Ramban says, once he knew that this was unusual, that it wasn't natural, he then spoke to Torah. He gives one possibility, or he assumed himself. One of his answers is that he himself came to the conclusion that she was a forbidden woman, but he was scared to go ahead. Or the other interpretation is that he actually asked her, and then she told him. Once she saw that he was frightened and that no harm could come to Abraham, then she told the truth. It fits in with my interpretation that on the one hand they were instinctual, on the other hand they had a very powerful superego, a conscience. They were very afraid, but it was a primitive religious kind of a thing. It wasn't a high level belief in God. It was just a superstitious fear. That's why he didn't rescind any of the. That's why he didn't rescind any of the gifts, because Avram was now a protected person. Now, another proof of the fact that he believed that everything that happened was a result of miracles is, as you know later on, who is Hagar, according to Rashi? Hagar is the daughter of Pharaoh. Rashi says later on, and how did she wind up in the household of Pharaoh? It says that as soon as Pharaoh saw the tremendous miracles that occurred, he said, better she should be a slave or a servant in the house of this one than a princess in my house. That's how impressed he was by the phenomena. That this was a man who had special... doesn't have to be a high level. It's not a high level. It's a level where he was simply... You see, anybody, even a person who's frightened, anybody would be very impressed by magic. Exactly. That's not a high level. That's a low level. A person who is religious purely because of miraculous phenomenon and magic and superstition, that's not a high level. Who was? Oh, yeah, Hagar was, because she grew up in the house of Abraham. Now, as far as why Abraham didn't... I'll take that up next week. Why didn't Abraham answer him? Now, of course, the next step was he got angry. He got angry at Abraham. Pharaoh got angry at Abraham. Of course, why did he get angry? Righteous indignation. He wouldn't look into himself. He wasn't on a level he would examine his own behavior. Right? Here he was being smitten. I mean, there's double anger, because first he was expecting it's a double blow. First he's expecting to have this beautiful woman, which he doesn't. That's not satisfied. B, he gets hit on top of it. So rather than look inward, he's going to take it out on Avram, because he's a righteous person. He's a righteous person. It would seem that he has some justification. In his own mind, he's a righteous person. Why did you lie to me? Why didn't you tell me that she's your wife? Would I sin? Why would... Now, of course, the question is why Avram didn't answer, and we'll take that up next week. But I want one more... Let's answer the last question. Is, was it just? Was it just, on the surface, that these people should be punished? Why were they punished? It says that they were subjected to a plague. When ostensibly they had not committed any sin, because Abram did say that she was a sister, and as far as they knew, she was permitted. But what wrong did they commit over here? Our Malkus gave an answer before. I'll repeat it. Lori, we have a principle that a person cannot be held responsible unless he has knowledge. He has to know that something seems to be shogeg, and not even shogeg. It's not even a shogeg. Shogeg is where you commit a sin by error. You forget that it's Shabbos. Or you know, remember that it's Shabbos, but you forget that you're not allowed to smoke a cigarette. That's a bad example. But I mean, that's shogeg. Where a person never knew in the first place, that's less than shogeg. So is it just, Mindy? I wanted to say, well, I say there's two possible ways you can answer it. First of all, you could say that really it wasn't a punishment, but that God intervened to save the righteous person. And these people, sometimes a person will suffer certain consequences because it's part of God's plan to save an individual. In order to do so, let's assume, for example, that God wants to save a righteous person. God knows that a certain plane is going to crash, and there's an individual who's extremely righteous, and God wants to save him and prevent him from getting there. So God will cause a tremendous snowstorm in that area. Now, this snowstorm may cause harm to people in that who just happen to be in that area, but they weren't on a level where they merited any special attention. That's one possibility. But I would say I prefer Mindy's answer, that they did bear responsibility, because the reason why this occurred was because they established a society which was based upon false principles in the first place, and that they were ready to kill a man, and he had to resort to this tactic in order to save his wife in the first place. So for establishing such a society, God may have let them go, and they would have received their punishment at a different time. But since it was necessary to save Abraham, so then what they got was coming to them anyway, and not just Pharaoh, but all of his ministers as well, because they all supported his system. So that when God punishes, it's not just the criminal himself, but anyone who's part of that criminal organization is equally responsible and culpable. So therefore what occurred to them was just because they established a society which was based upon the principle of instinctual gratification, and they had no scruples in taking the wife of a man. And if they had to, they would have killed him. So therefore they were deserving of this punishment. And God did not bring it upon them until God had a necessity to do so. They may not have gotten the punishment. God may have let them just go until they died, whatever. But since it was necessary to save Abraham, and that entailed the punishment, it was coming to them, it was justified. Yes, Lord? At this stage of the game, unless I have to alter it, is that this punishment was not intended to uplift Mitzrayim. It was only intended to save the righteous man. Mitzrayim was beyond being helped by this. They were not raised to a higher spiritual level as a result of this. They remained on the level of superstition. However, the case of Abimelech was different. I don't want to give away the interpretation, but that was different. The intention over there was not only to save Avram, but there was an additional purpose, which I'll try and bring out. But here I'm saying it was not intended to raise him to a higher level. Who? That's the principle of Yaakov. Ain Sonkin El and Ace. And that's why you could ask the same question. Why did Yaakov, when he confronted Esav, why did he divide his camp? When they were so small a number and they were overwhelming odds, why didn't he just... Then he prayed to God. Because our principle is that we have to do everything that we can do, and then we have to pray to God. Remind me, it's a little bit late. Remind me, I didn't explain what the Nisayon was. Rashi says that this famine that God caused, which is very powerful, and caused him to leave the land, was actually intended to test Avram's emuna. I didn't explain that tonight, but please remind me. The fact that he accepted God's decree, and he was not maharer, he didn't ponder, he didn't question God's midos. Now here God told me, that's what Rashi says, that here God told me to come to Canaan, and now there's a famine and I have to leave. And Avram just followed without questioning. Now I want to explain what that perfection is that he didn't question. What would be so terrible if he did question? But I didn't have time tonight. Please remind me. And we'll continue next week. You know what to study. I hope this is a good time for everybody.